So I'm very pleased to welcome David Estland, who's going to present his paper entitled Utopophobia. He is going to be replied to by David Miller afterwards. David Estland, as soon as you're ready.
Thank you. Well, let me start by adding my own personal testimony just briefly. I owe Jerry an awful lot as well, and I think of it as sort of starting off my intellectual career with a lot of excitement, and just so briefly, here's how it happened. Everybody has their stories, but I think it was I think it was about 1979. I was an undergraduate at Wisconsin, so this goes way back, and I'd written a paper on Jerry's chapter on functional explanation in the book on Karl Marx. And lucky for me, Jerry came to give a couple papers at Wisconsin, and I went to one of the smaller sessions and felt sort of out of place, a lowly undergraduate among these exalted graduate students and faculty and so on, and waited sort of to the end to raise my little question, which I did ask. And I was feeling a little dismissed by the people around me. They didn't agree. They thought I was misunderstanding and so on, and Jerry sort of focused on me like a laser beam and said, no. He sort of shushed them and said, no, here's what he's saying and so on. And I was immediately very excited. And so the session was almost over, but he said, send me your paper, which I did, so I was thrilled. I thought that was the end of that, but that was great. But 2 weeks later, I got a letter from Jerry, 2 or 3 pages of really detailed consideration of my arguments, which I had never received before, much less from a famous philosopher, which he was already at that time. So that was even more exciting. Most exciting of all for me is the reply seemed to be inadequate. So I sent a rejoinder, and maybe not quite as exciting, but also exciting. He cited it in print and so on. I was still just an undergraduate, and this made us fast friends and qualified him in my mind later to become a letter writer for me, and I think that's I owe a lot to his willingness to back me to get a good start to my career and so on. And I regard him as a mentor. I've never taken a class from him, but I've thanked him for this in little ways now and then, and he expresses a certain amount of bafflement. I think that's because I don't think he sees it so much as a kind of a generosity, which he is also very generous, but just intellectual focus and honesty, right? He just is interested in the point, you know? But I think we should thank him for that every bit as much, so. Okay, let me start out with the sort of context. What I want to do today is talk about this idea I call utopophobia, which I just broached briefly at the end of a book I wrote came out about a year ago on democracy. And the thought was, the theory of democracy that I was developing, I realized when I sort of finished the book that there was going to be a kind of criticism that said, but you and I both know people are never going to do this. And my instinct was to say, well, I never said they would. And so I sort of wanted to develop why I wasn't so worried by that criticism. So I should say I'm not sure that there's nothing to that criticism, but the stage of this that I'm in, and I see this as at the early stage of a longer project, is try to push the I never said they would line and try to find the limits of this. So it's received wisdom that normative political theory, shouldn't be utopian. And I'm sure there's wisdom in that, but it's not really clear what it means, and it can have a kind of chilling effect. If we're not clear about what kind of theorizing is being proscribed by that, there's a risk that a lot of valuable projects would go unpursued for no good reason. So to be more precise, my thesis is this, that it's not a defect of any kind in a normative political theory if its prescriptions or its preconditions will almost certainly, or even certainly, never be met. So this rebuts a rather specific complaint. And not all the different things that might be meant by a charge of utopianism or ideal theory are captured here, but I think it would turn out to be very clarifying if we show that this specific version of the complaint can't be sustained. And then you push the critic to other ones, and I feel fairly good about the terrain that we're on then, but maybe that'll come up in discussion. A couple of the other complaints that are in the background, I'm not going to say much about, but I will touch on briefly, is that such theories of the kind I'm going to defend might be true, but they're not important. So I think you might worry about that. And even if they're important, it might not be an appropriate use of your time. So there are ways to push the criticism in those ways, even granting the very narrow thing I'm going to say, which is there's nothing wrong with the theory. And I'll address those briefly, but they're not my main concern. I'm not taking any stand on the view, certainly not opposing the view, that some people might say, well, there's nothing wrong with this sort of impractical kind of political theorizing, but there are lots of other important things. And so some people think there's just too much of this impractical theorizing. You also need to do these other more practical kinds of things. I have no quarrel with that. I'm not arguing for the preeminence of this more, I guess you could say, idealistic kind of theorizing. Just its appropriateness or legitimacy. As I say sometimes, I love what they do. I just want to be loved back. Right? You often get not the same respect for the ideal theorizing as I have for them. You might also ask, and I'm interested in hearing people's thoughts about this, who are the utopophobes that I'm criticizing? So who are these people? And it's a little hard to pin them down in print. I have some examples, but I'm not going to sort of textually look at specific examples. But I can tell you, when I give this paper, they're there. And you may be out there, so we'll find out. I will say Machiavelli is one who says something quite explicit like this. And people talk about, again, this a little bit indirect, but Sen, in his thing about transcendental theories, talks about the goal of theory for it to be useful. And this points in the kind of direction that I'm worried about. In the context of democracy, which is where I first started thinking about this, Richard Posner has a big book called Law, Pragmatism, and Democracy, where he quite explicitly comes out against what I'm calling the, what as you'll see it, the term is hopeless aspirational theory. Okay, so section two, ability and probability, just very briefly, and I'll come back to that. So a couple quotes from Rousseau that are interesting in this context. He says in The Social Contract, everyone knows, that he proposes to take men as they are and laws as they might be. This taking men as they are is supposed to be some kind of disavowal of the sin of utopianism. It's interesting and difficult to see how that actually plays a role in what Rousseau goes on to do. But the same Rousseau in Emile says, I love this quote, propose what can be done, they never stop repeating to me. It's as if I were told, propose doing what is done. So let's define a kind of a continuum with vices on either end. So too much realisticness and not enough realisticness. So on one end, we'll have the thing that Rousseau is ridiculing, the idea that you just propose what is done because now you're being good and realistic, right? Nobody thinks that's the way to do normative theorizing, right? And so we can give that a derogatory label. Let's call that complacent realism. That's a sort of absurd version. Don't propose anything that isn't being done because otherwise it's unrealistic to some degree. What's on the other end? And here, just moving to section three. Not all the sections are going to go that quickly, I should warn you. So on the end that I'm going to regard as properly called utopian, so I'm not defending utopian theory. I'm going to let utopianism stand as an epithet, something we should avoid. So the question is, what is the thing we should avoid? Well, here's one thing. I'm going to grant that ought implies can. Now, that's an absolutely unambiguous principle, but so I'm going to just use it in a broad way. The idea is this, that if some agent can't do an action, then that agent isn't required to do that action. And as you'll see in my paper, I move between individuals being addressed with oughts like this, and the question is their ability or inability, and also to groups, states, and so on, having oughts addressed to the group or the state, and the question is the group's or state's inability. So I'm going to grant that if there's a theory that requires a society to do something that that society is not able to do, that requirement is false. I'm not going to defend the ought implies can principle, and I'm not sure about it, so this is for the sake of argument. Let's say at least that would be inappropriately unrealistic. So let's say ought implies can. I'm also going to grant, and there's a number of things that could go under this second category, but let's say that ought implies not unreasonably costly or burdensome. Right? So a lot of people think that that's a legitimate restriction on oughts, is that if it's just too burdensome or too costly, or in a somewhat broader way of putting it, the agent doesn't have enough of the kind of reason to do the thing. Let's grant that there are also constraints of that kind. I'm not going to say too much about that. So ought implies can, let's say. Ought implies not unreasonably costly or burdensome. But my point is, ought does not imply reasonably likely. That's an absurd principle, and yet this kind of objection does get used in normative political theory. The sort of you and I both know that'll never happen. That's about how likely it is. That's not ought implies can. That's not implies unreasonably costly. That's just ought implies reasonably likely, and that's not something we should accept. Section four. So in between those two poles, those two vices, complacent realism on the one hand and this kind of utopianism that requires what can't be done. It's a range of theory, and let's call that whole range in between, it's not the perfect name for it, but call it aspirational theory. Now let's divide that up one more time, because in that range of aspirational theory, there are going to be things that there's strong reason to think will never be done. They could be done, they're not beyond people's abilities. They aren't actually done now, but there's also strong reason to believe they'll never be done, and let's call that the hopeless aspirational kind of theory. It puts requirements on people. There's no argument that they couldn't do it, but every argument that they never will. So, and just call the complement class hopeful. That is, it just means not hopeless. Now, you might think with those names, what I'm going to defend is hopeful aspirational theory. That sounds like, but no, my point is to defend hopeless aspirational theory, right? Because my thesis is, it's no defect in a normative theory if its prescriptions will probably or even certainly not be lived up to. That's the hopeless kind. And I want to say, right, there's nothing wrong with a theory on that basis. Okay, section 5, returning to the probability-ability distinction. So it's tempting, or at least you see people making this slide, to conclude about what I'm calling hopeless theories, that they violate ought implies can. But they don't, right? So the ability of people to do something is entirely different from the probability that they'll do it. So in fact, low probability doesn't even entail difficulty or burdensomeness. So we might think ought implies not too burdensome, and you say, and we know they'll never do that. But that doesn't show it's costly or burdensome. It just shows they're not going to do it. So think of this example, an individual example, not a collective one. Take my word for it, it's within my ability to dance like a chicken at some point during this talk. But also take my word for it, that's not going to happen. The probability is extremely low. Now you might think it's not quite zero, I'm not so sure. And it won't matter that much for my purposes. But the low probability, however low it goes, that has no tendency at all to bring along with it a reduction of ability, right? Probability and ability are not connected in this way. So I'm not going to do it, but it's actually easy. You just put your thumbs up under your arms and I'm not going to do it.
If I offered you $10 million.
We can talk. So if you argued that I was obligated to dance like a chicken, I wouldn't be able to object on the grounds of ought implies can. Of course I could dance like a chicken, I'm just not going to. Now I think we should say the same thing about requirements on societies or groups. I'll come back to this idea of having requirements on groups as such. But the mere fact that they're extremely unlikely to do something tells us nothing about whether or to what degree they're able to do it. And so ought implies can isn't triggered. There's a distinction in ways we might use the concept of human nature that travels frequently with the appeals to utopianism, right? So sometimes what we mean by human nature is really just a probabilistic claim, right? Sometimes people speak as if there's a law of human nature when it's really a kind of probabilistic law or generalization about what people are likely to do or how they do act, and so on. So think of some socialist thought, for example, might purport to require that we be less selfish than we have any reason to expect people actually ever to be, right? And so it's sometimes said that that's a requirement that's not consistent with human nature, right? People are more selfish than this theory requires. So this in turn sounds as if it must be treated as beyond human abilities, right? You're requiring them to be less selfish. We know people will never be less selfish. That's a law of human nature. So this violates ought implies can, but that's a fallacy, right? It might well be that human nature is selfish, but that doesn't show that people couldn't be less selfish. We just might know for pretty well sure that they're not going to be less selfish. I mean, in fact, we also know that in human nature, in the probabilistic sense, to be morally imperfect, but that hardly cancels the requirements, right? The requirements they could meet, we just know they won't. But sometimes human nature is used to actually refer to abilities. I think that's a less common use of the concept of human nature. I'm not sure what you think. You don't usually hear appeals to human nature when the question is that it's requiring too much human strength or too much human intelligence. But you could use it in that way. But obviously in that case, I'm granting. If what you mean by human, it violates human nature in the sense that this is requiring things of people they can't do, then I'm granting the requirement is specious. There's a category of things that we can call psychological ability or psychological inability. I'm going to put that off for a minute. That's a very common use of the concept of human nature. That's something people couldn't get themselves to do. And now you have that word could there. It sounds like ought implies can, might be triggered. I'm going to come back to that, but just to anticipate, I'm going to argue that these aren't normally inabilities. Sometimes they are, but not normally. So if human nature is a set of probabilistic facts or so-called laws, it has no bearing on what's required at all, and at least by way of ought implies can. Of course, probabilities of compliance, I should say this up front, the probabilities of compliance with the rule are very important considerations, and they may go into various decisions we make about what to do and so on. But the point at the moment is that they don't bear on the soundness of the requirement, just to show that people aren't likely to meet it. The requirement stands, and then you will have to ask this other question, which I'll say more about, well, now what should we do? Given they're not going to do what they really should do, what should we do? And then, in turn, what should they do as a second best? Section 6. I think, so there's this second kind of theorizing that says, what should we do given that we aren't going to do what we really should do, or all things considered should do? Let's call that the kind of theory that asks that question concessive theory. So there's some requirement, then we say, people aren't going to do that. Now we need a theory that sets up new requirements in light of that fact, so it concedes the failure first. I think we should separate these two levels and call the first one aspirational theory and the second one concessive theory. They're both perfectly, I'm not criticizing concessive theory at all. If somebody said that's even more important than aspirational theory, I have no problem with that. Just want to be loved back. Some people say that the concessive kind of theorizing, at least in politics, that's the really important thing, because that's the thing that's practical or of practical importance. But I'm not sure there's any real basis for that. And so I'm going to make a couple points with this example from individual ethical considerations. First of all, to note that the aspirational concessive distinction does occur in individual moral thinking, too. So there's an example, thanks to Frank Jackson and Robert Pargetter, called Professor Procrastinate. We all know him. He's obligated for one reason or another to write a review for a journal. But he knows about himself that if he accepts this assignment, he won't do it on time, and things will be a mess. So I think we can say there's at the aspirational level, he ought to accept and perform, right? By hypothesis, he's got an obligation to accept. We don't know why. Maybe he promised or he owes the journal this. So he ought to accept and perform. Then there's a concessive level. Given that he's not going to perform, he shouldn't accept. Now, some people say the concessive level is the realistic one. You can say that. And in that respect, it has a certain kind of special practical value. But the aspirational level should hardly be disqualified as being practical in any way that should disqualify it from being a true or valid moral claim. He ought to accept and perform. It doesn't get canceled in any way. This might seem to lead to a puzzle. How can it be that he ought to accept and perform, and also, given that he won't perform, he ought not to accept? Is there a contradiction there? He ought to accept and perform, but he ought not to accept. I think the answer is there's no contradiction there at all, because it doesn't follow from he ought to accept and perform that he ought to accept. And this is kind of a general idea that has application in a wide range of cases, that the general idea, put somewhat vaguely so it covers all these different contexts, is I think we all know that lots of times values or desiderata have their value only in a package, right? This is closely related to I'll come back to the thing about second best. But so think of a surgeon who we say ought to do the surgery and stitch up the patient. Well, without more information, we can't say whether he ought to do the surgery, right? Because we don't know if he's going to stitch up the patient. And if he's not going to stitch up the patient, it's not the case that he ought to do the surgery. But he ought to do the surgery and stitch him up. Those values, there's two things that have value, only as a package. So there's no contradiction when we back up and say he ought not to do the surgery. There's no contradiction. So there's two equally valid moral claims, the one he ought to do it and stitch him up, and the other one he ought not to do it. They're both practical. And the familiar thought, kind of in social thought more generally, goes under the name of the theory of second best, right? When you have a number of desiderata that apply as a package, once one of them is not going to be met, the value of the other ones goes back into question. Right? That's the same basic idea. Okay, so here's another way. So you might think the aspirational level is somehow refuted by showing it's not practically significant, and I think that is one way of arguing against that. Here's another just sort of by the way context where a practical imperative might have a moral imperative might have no practical relevance, but we don't think that begins to refute it. So think of all kinds of moral rules that we live under, like don't target civilians when fighting in a war. Well, I think I'm subject to that. That's an important moral principle. It has no practical relevance for me for various circumstantial reasons. I'm probably never going to be in a situation where I'll have to decide whether to abide by that. Or don't withhold information from the War Crimes Tribunal. I don't think I'm likely to face that. Or don't withhold information from Congress. I sure hope I'm never going to have to. Right? So those are, in a certain sense, not practical. Right? They don't guide my action in any actual decision. But they don't fail to be practical in the sense that disqualifies them as genuine moral truth that really do apply to me. Okay, section 7, oughts, cans, and groups. When we turn to groups, there's a common way of reasoning that I think is a fallacy too, and it goes like this. We could never get people to do this thing, phi. Philosophers use the variable phi, right? We could never get people to phi. So by ought implies can, society isn't required to phi. Well, in this case, the thing that can't be done isn't phi, but the person who's saying they can't get them to phi. Right? So if the getting can't be done, right? So we could never get people to do this. Well, what can't be done? The getting. Well, by ought implies can, then you're not required to get them to. Doesn't follow they're not required to do it. We haven't shown they can't do it. An example in a sort of homely individual case again is suppose your son is required, as sons are, to be in school on time every morning. And you might think, or you might say to the principal, it's impossible to get him there on time. He spends all this time preening and listening to his music. It's impossible for me to get him to school on time. It's an unreasonable requirement. And the principal should say, you're not required to get him to school on time. He's required to get to school on time, and he can perfectly well do that. He's not going to, but he could, and so ought implies can, doesn't block it. You are off the hook. I think this is actually a powerful source of resistance to what I call aspirational political theory. I think that's a very common slide. The theory says here's what people should do, and then people move to the mode of institutional design and say, but we'll never be able to get them to do it. That sounds like an ability problem. Ought implies can. It's not required. Fallacy, right? So consider requirement that there be no nepotism in government hiring. And you might say, we can't ever get people to do that. Well, that's true. But they could perfectly well do it. They're not going to do it, I think, right? It's never going to be lived up to. But the institutional designer isn't required to get them to do it. If the institutional designer can't get them to do it, that doesn't cancel the requirement in question. When should I finish, by the way? I'm just going to watch the clock carefully.
Well, about 40 to 45 minutes, so another 20.
By 25 minutes or so?
Yeah, 25.
Thanks. Okay, so section 8 on psychological inability. This is an ongoing project, and this is something I have a lot more thinking to do about. So I just want to tell you some things I have so far and interested to get more help on this. So sometimes we say something psychologically impossible. Sometimes that's what's at play and appeals to human nature. And normally when this is said, it's a case where apart from this consideration about psychological inability, we're talking about an action that would seem to be within the agent's ability otherwise. So then you back off and say, well, they could do it, but they could never get themselves to do it. Now for my purposes, I want to put aside cases of addiction or mental defect or illness, okay? And just think about cases where it's some other source of not being able to get yourself to do it. So you might go back to the chicken dancing thing for a slightly different use this time. It's not difficult to dance like a chicken while presenting a paper. But I doubt that I could get myself to do it. It's sort of striking here how our language parallels the difference I discussed between the students being at school on time and the parent being able to get them to do it. Now I could say this about an individual. I could do it, I just couldn't get myself to do it. Okay. Call this the getting gap, just because I want to refer back to it various times. So there's an interpersonal case and an intrapersonal case, you might say. And Professor Procrastinate might be like this. It's no part of the original use of the example, but we can imagine this. He might be well motivated to some extent to sort of overcome his tardiness, but he predictably fails. He can't get himself to do it. He wants to, but he can't get himself to do it. Should we say that he can't get himself to do it? Is that right? And does that name an action which, because it's beyond his abilities, turns out he's not required to do? Ought implies can, after all. I'm not sure what to say exactly about that, but suppose we allowed it. Professor Procrastinate finds it impossible to get himself to write reviews on time, and does that exonerate him when he's late? Well, that seems clearly false. Even if you want to describe this as he can't get himself to do it, we're putting aside sort of compulsion, defect, illness, pathological cases. He's just the kind of familiar Professor Procrastinate. And even if we want to use this modal can't and can't get himself to do it, okay, maybe that's all right. But that doesn't exonerate him, does it, from being late? I'm just this kind of person. I can never get myself to do it. Well, it just means you're lazy, extremely lazy. So I think really the general lesson I want to draw from that is, even if there are cases that will allow to be described as can't get myself to do it, or people can't get themselves to do this, apart from certain extreme cases, and I don't know exactly what the line is here, but, you know, mental defect, compulsion, addiction, things like that, there is no use of ought implies can that blocks the requirement in this case. So consider a Platonic Republic in which mothers believe they should surrender their children to the state to be communally raised, but they can't get themselves to do it. Well, the way to handle that example, I think, is just to say that we're inclined to doubt there really is such a duty. Okay, so I doubt that any sound theory of justice would actually have that implication. But the problem isn't that it asks anything of anyone that's beyond their ability. They perfectly well could give their kids over. They're not that heavy, and so on. It's not that far to the office that you have to take them to. They can't get themselves to. But I think that's not the problem. There's no ought implies can there. The problem here is that it's just a specious theory of justice that purports to require this. Different example. Consider a theory according to which society is not just unless most people forego a certain amount of extra income they could get in order to choose careers that benefit people who are badly off. Suppose if people don't act that way, the society is unjust. Well, a couple points. First, we might all agree it's very unlikely, depending on where we set this level of this requirement, very unlikely ever to be satisfied. But that's not relevant, as I've said, to the question whether it's required by justice. Probability doesn't have that role. And second, of course, it might be beyond people's abilities because unduly burdensome what's being required. And I'm saying ought implies not unduly burdensome, so that would be fine. But let's set the requirement so it's not unduly burdensome. Then the requirement's not blocked by that. Ought implies not unreasonably burdensome. But a third point is, suppose it's true that most people can't get themselves to do it. Okay? They're just too tempted by the extra money. I'm willing to allow the language, if it's because it does seem so idiomatic to say people can't get themselves to do this. But I think to invoke ought implies can there is just a bad argument. Let the can't get language work. I don't think we think people would be exonerated by the fact that they're so tempted by the money. That's all it is. They're so tempted by the money. They're just very tempted to violate the requirement. That's about as bad as an objection to a moral requirement as we know. So I think that kind of objection fails. But it's a common kind of objection. People say, this requires a lot of selflessness. Suppose it's not more than they could do, and it's not that it's so costly they don't have reasons. The appeal is to say something, but it's beyond human nature. You say, in what sense? Just probabilistic? No, it's this other thing. They can't get themselves to do it. It's beyond human nature in that way, so it violates ought implies can. And my reply is, no, all you've shown is that they're sorely tempted to violate it. They can't get themselves to it in that way, and that, I think, makes it look pretty clearly like a failure as an objection. Okay, turning to Section 9, questions about moral individualism. Another thing I have a lot more thinking to do, so I'm amusing you here to get your feedback on some of this stuff. So when I speak of oughts or requirements attaching to societies, we ought to worry a little bit about whether oughts apply directly to collectives. Some people think that concepts like action, intention, obligation, and so on can apply to groups in certain circumstances, but that they have to be analyzed into applications of these same concepts to the members in some way. There's a, you know, big literature on various ways to try to do this. Here's a very simple minimal principle that might sort of lay the basis for this kind of approach. Call it the group member principle. It's not enough for an account of how you would translate these things into individual requirements, but just a very minimal claim. You might be tempted by this principle. There's no obligation on a group unless there's at least some member of the group upon whom there's the same obligation, or some closely associated one. You have to go to this closely associated point because a lot of times the action in question is just sort of a category mistake to apply to individuals. Like, the group ought to sing the chord G major 7. It's part of the contract. Well, an individual can't sing a chord. It's got four distinct tones or whatever, right? But the idea of the principle is there's no obligation on the group to sing this chord unless there's some closely associated obligation on individuals. Well, it would be to sing their assigned note, something like that. Just for what it's worth, my intuition about whether this is a good principle is weakened a lot by the fact that we have to go to closely associated. It would be a nice, elegant principle if you said there's no obligation on a group unless there's an obligation on at least one member to do the same thing. That's a very elegant principle. If you say there's no obligation on a group unless there's an obligation on at least a member to do something, it's not that intuitively compelling, but anyway, it may turn out to be true. I'm not sure it's true, and you might ask, well, what if it weren't true? Do we get some kind of contradiction or paradox, or do things go haywire? Well, if that principle weren't true, if there could be collective imperatives with no associated individual imperatives, all that would mean is that there's sort of the moral equivalent of a prisoner's dilemma. But that's no contradiction. All it would mean is there are things that are sort of, you could have a case where even if every individual does what they're required to do, the group won't do what it's required to do. That's the closest we come to any paradox resulting from this. That's not a paradox. It's just exactly parallel to the normal prisoner's dilemma, which is puzzling and troubling, but it's not immediately a refutation of the idea of instrumental rationality. So anyway, I just mentioned that principle. I wonder what people think. And let me say this too. So suppose you had the view that there can be obligations on collectives or groups, but only when it's analyzed out in some individualistic way. That's fine with me because that would still allow it to be true that the group has the collective, that has the obligation, and that's all I need. I don't need to deny that it's in virtue of some individually analyzed account. Another thing, section 10, about the issue about applying these things to collectives. One kind of case that's often spoken of as an inability at the collective level, or at least it might be tempting to do so, is the case of collective action problems, right? These are familiar. Members of some group face incentives such that their own best means to their ends are going to lead them to a collective outcome that's worse for everyone than if they'd chosen differently. So sometimes people look at a theory or a proposal and describe it as this is a collective inability because of the collective action problem. Or at least we might ask, what about the claim that that's an inability? I think that's just not, we don't yet have any argument that that's an inability at the collective level. Just because, say, self-interested or however they are motivated individuals won't contribute in the way that would avoid the collectively suboptimal result, doesn't show they can't. It's a collective action problem because given their incentives, they won't, right? Where's the inability, right? There's no individual inability here, and barring some special informational coordination problem or whatever, but that's a separate topic, suppose that's not the problem. It's just the incentives are going to lead them here. We don't have any individual inability that yet would allow us to say the collective can't do this. And we now know from what I said before, we can't back up and say, no, the inability is that we can't get people to do this. These incentives are too strong. Because remember what I say about that. Well, then you're not required to get them to. That doesn't show they're not required to do it. So sort of tentatively, I think collective action problems don't count as inabilities in the sense that it would allow us to block requirements by way of what implies can. Section 11, let me say a little bit about this term ideal theory. So you might say, oh, he's defending ideal theory, this is a big literature, and so on. I haven't used that term ideal theory for a couple reasons. One is, it seems to stand for a number of different things, so I wouldn't want to be confusing in that way. But another thing is that there's one relatively clear meaning, at least, that you could give to it, and I'm not doing that. So let me just pick one thing that Onora O'Neill proposes. One way to understand ideal theory is that it uses idealization in the following sense. It gives us a normative theory starting with premises or assumptions that the theorist knows to be false. It's idealization in that sense. She's quite right to point out that that doesn't yet mean that these premises name ideals. That would be a further thing. These premises might be good in some way if they were met. That's a separate kind of idealization. Her point is just, suppose we know them to be false. Now, why might we do that? It might be that we want a theory that has premises that name ideals to learn some moral stuff. That's one reason we might do it. Or it might just be for purposes of simplicity. It might be an intractable theoretical problem if we built in the real premises. So we do ones we know are false and at least learn what we can from that. Okay. So that's a good, clear meaning you might have for ideal theory. Assumption of full compliance is like that, and it kind of seems to me waffle between these two motives. It's partly for simplicity. At least we sort of know what the levels of compliance are. Let's just pick this very simple one so we can reason about it. But we could have also picked universal noncompliance, which isn't done very often. So I think it's a combination of simplicity and that the assumptions are morally good in some way, so that we're learning something moral. So, but I want to say what I'm calling aspirational theory isn't like this. It doesn't rest on any false assumptions. Theories that do are not necessarily bad. There are good reasons sometimes for using false assumptions, right? But that's not what aspirational theory does. So consider a theory that says society ought to do A, B, and C, but we know they won't do A. Now, as we've seen, we can't assume now that it should do B or C, right? Nevertheless, there's no cause for withdrawing the claim that it ought to do A. There's no cause for withdrawing the claim that it ought to do A, B, and C. Now, if that requirement that society ought to do A, B, and C were conditional on some false assumption like they're going to do B, is that the one I said they won't do? No, A. Okay. Right? It was conditional on some false assumption like they're going to do A, then we'd have to withdraw the conclusion in viva voce anyway that they ought to do A, B, and C. But aspirational theory doesn't do that. It's not premised on the assumption they'll do B and say, and then, therefore, they should do A, B, and C. It says the following. They should do A, B, and C, and they're not going to do B. That's it. It doesn't withdraw the conclusion. The conclusion is not conditional on any false assumption. So, for better or for worse, that's different than the O'Neill kind of ideal theory, which has this, you know, interesting and puzzling feature of intentionally building in false assumptions. Aspirational theory does not withdraw its requirement just by showing that we know these things won't be met. There's lots more to be done about ideal theory and relations between what I'm doing and ideal theory, but that's just a starter. Okay, here's a very natural worry about what I call hopeless aspirational theory. You know, theories especially that say people, society ought to be like this, which includes people being very conscientious in all sorts of ways, including, say, full compliance with all the rules. Imagine a theory like that. But it's often argued that, well, if everybody was conscientious in that way and everybody was complying with all the rules, you wouldn't have much need for police or courts or maybe even laws or legislators. Where's the politics? Right? So this isn't political theory, is the objection. I'm not moved by that objection because it just rests so much on the definition of politics. Right? So this theory could grant that, if necessary, that politics so defined as involving, you know, police and courts and laws and punishment, stuff like that, would be absent or obsolete in a society like this. But that would be no objection to the claim that we had discovered the true theory of justice. It's not addressing that. It just says that wouldn't count as political in some sense. And I think the theorist should say political schmolitical. If it's a true theory of justice, you call it political or don't. It doesn't matter. Second point about that is I think it's very unlikely that even a just society with full compliance and virtue and all these things really could do without familiar institutions of police, courts, and laws, and legislators. For one thing, there's lots of things that might put people into conflict other than violation of moral or legal norms. There might be reasonable disagreements about facts or conflicting aims even in cases where each person is morally right to pursue their aim, even if it leads to conflict. And then you're going to need adjudication, and you might have good justification for punishment, and so on. So, again, I'm not trying to settle that, but it's not at all clear that this is true, that if you had full compliance and full virtue, that you wouldn't need police, laws, courts, and so on. Okay, 13, importance and the use of time. I said I would just briefly touch on these things, although they're not central. So these two separate issues, somebody might say, well, okay, now I'm convinced that there's nothing wrong, nothing false about a theory just because it requires things we know will never happen. But it's not important. It's not an important endeavor to theorize like this. Let me lump these together just for the sake of time. I see the clock. So take a case of higher math. Okay, it's also very impractical. At least I'm told by mathematicians that much of higher math, that's kind of gets pursued by great mathematicians, on, is not thought to have any serious chance of making any practical difference. Some math, of course, does. Some sophisticated math. Sort of the higher maths, no practical relevance. That's a perfectly good question why that's important. And maybe you want to say that's not important, but my task right now would just be to say the kind of theorizing that I'm defending is in that category, right? Maybe it's important, maybe it's not, but it's not obvious that higher math is not important, and I just want to be on the same terrain, rather than think that because it's political theory, it has some special need to be practically important. Say no. There are other kinds of importance for theoretical work. You can argue with that, but then that would just put this kind of theorizing on all fours with higher math, and I'd be happy with that. And basically the same thing about how you should spend your time. So somebody might say, well, okay, if you could prove these abstract theorems in math or whatever, I can't deny that's important, but that's not an appropriate way to spend your time. And basically, I just want to take no stand on that. I have no thesis about how you should spend your time. Right? If you grant that it's important work, there's nothing false about the theory, that's as far as I want to go. It may be that if you reflect seriously on how you should spend your time, you shouldn't be an academic at all. I mean, so these are tough questions, but nothing in my thesis says anything about how anybody should spend their time. Okay, 14. So some institutions might have no point except in a concessive theory, one that asks, what should we do in light of the fact that we won't be doing all that we should be doing? So suppose that if we did all we should, there would be no point in having institutions of punishment. Now, I said I'm not sure that's right, but suppose that was true. But since we don't do all we should, we do need institutions of punishment. But now we have to ask what they ought to be like. So we're at concessive theory now, right? Suppose people are doing everything they should, aren't doing everything they should, concessive. Now what should we do? Well, we should have prisons and things like that. So we're in concessive theory. So the question would be, what kinds of institutions of punishment should we have? Well, prison staff should presumably abide by certain fair and decent standards. The prisoners ought to behave as they're directed to behave. That would be all part of one thing we might say about what prisons we should have. But in fact, suppose the guards aren't going to live up to those standards. Now we need a second level of concessive theory. Right? So I want to point out that this is a nested thing, and that there's an important point sort of at the end of this. We move from aspirational to concessive, so we ask what institutions we have. We're going to have another aspirational concessive set of questions. We might say, here are the rules for the guards, here are the norms for the prisoners, and then we say, well, wait a minute, they're not going to live up to those. Now, how should we structure it? It's concessive again. To point out that that's concessive again shows that you have to have a name for the other thing. Well, that's relatively aspirational. Okay. So, normative political theory might start out by, might concede nothing. That would be sort of purely aspirational theory. Or it might sort of concede some things and not others, kind of mixed case of concessive and aspirational. And you might say it might concede everything. But just an interesting point, I think there's a limit. It's not clear that it makes any sense for a theory to concede all the facts about what we will do. Right? Take those all for granted and then, well, there's nothing to be normative about anymore. Right? So there's a limit. could be all aspirational. You could have the mixed case. You could concede most things, but there's nothing left to be normative about if you start by conceding everything. And what that shows, I think, is that there's just no basis for thinking aspirational theory is somehow unimportant or illegitimate or whatever. There's no such thing as normative theorizing that isn't, to some degree, aspirational. Sorry, hopeless aspirational. So this brings us back to the absurdity of what I call complacent realism. Even if we knew all the facts, including what everyone will do, then unless every alternative is beyond their abilities, all normative theory must be partly aspirational. So that the fact that to claim that there are important theoretical truths of a hopeless aspirational kind, I think should be beyond dispute. And then I think once that structural point is clear from this nested level of concessive aspirational, then I don't see any good objection to hopeless aspirational theory of all the different degrees, all the way up, including the limiting case of a normative political theory that requires a lot and concedes nothing. Okay, lastly, just two more minutes on danger. So hopeless aspirational theory, of course, could be recklessly used as a practical program, right, in inappropriate context. This is a familiar worry about theories that are charged with being utopian. Now, the fact that it might be used recklessly is no defect in the theory. That's pretty obvious. And nor would it show that it's not worth pursuing in any way. It would show at most that you ought to be careful how you present or publicize your work. Right? So somebody might say, well, that's a dangerous kind of theory, because somebody might take this and try to reform society to meet it. And since, as you grant, that's hopeless, this could be a disaster. Okay? So there are really interesting questions about responsibilities on intellectuals as to how they should present their work in cases like this. And I'm just not taking the question up, but it's a fascinating one. My point is that this is no argument against the theory. And I hope there's no good argument that goes from this consideration to you shouldn't do this kind of theorizing. That would be, I suppose, in extreme cases that could. More likely, it would just show you have to be very careful about how you present your work. And maybe in some contexts, you should be fairly quiet about your work. Again, I hope that's not true, or we hope we live in a situation where that's not true. But those are big, interesting questions. They're not inconsistent with my thesis in any way. Here's a small suggestion kind of to finish up. So it might be that the danger of hopeless theory, in that it might be pursued recklessly or irresponsibly, might be mitigated if, rather than refraining from doing it, we more clearly insisted that normative political theory is not all meant to offer any guidance at all about what to do, given what we know and what the probabilities are. Right? You risk this danger if you say, well, it's political theorizing, so it's practical. It's all got to be practical. So this must offer some guidance about what we should do. I'm rejecting that, as should be clear by now. And as a sort of last little plea for this, you might say, that might mitigate the danger. Because you might say, wait a minute, it's a political theory, but careful, is it just aspirational? Or is it concessive in a way that actually implies something practical? Not all normative political theory tells anybody about what they ought to do, given what we know. So I'll stop there.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, David has prepared your plans.
Yeah. So, I think for those who've read it and what David has said is close to the paper, it's a very interesting and stimulating paper, and it raises, I think, some quite fundamental questions about what political philosophy is or should be. And I think it's also, its relation to Jerry's work in particular is I think, fairly clear. David, like Jerry, wants to defend a certain kind of ideal theorizing about politics, particularly theorizing that's not heavily constrained by present-day political realities. I'm not so sure that their positions are identical, since David does remain critical of a certain kind of utopianism, which demands what is physically or morally impossible. And as I see it, that contravenes Jerry's requirement that fundamental principles in political philosophy should be fact-independent. So, I mean, David's basic principles are supposed to be non-utopian, and so it's a necessary condition of their validity that it should be possible to implement them, which is a question of fact. Nevertheless, David's main aim is to counteract what he describes as the chilling effect of anti-utopianism or realism in political theory, and to that extent, I think David and Jerry are on the same side of the barricades, so to speak. So I want to start by reflecting for a bit on the idea of political philosophy itself, because I think the two halves of that compound term can come to seem in conflict with each other, the political and the philosophical, pulling in different directions. And that may lead to the conclusion that, for example, I think Michael Oakeshott sometimes drew, that there can be no such thing as political philosophy, thought being here that political thinking is practical, while philosophical thinking is theoretical or speculative. Now, David, I think, doesn't address this question directly, but at different points in his paper, he does seem drawn towards different answers to it. So, for instance, he, at one point, does assume that political philosophy ought to be practical in the sense of action guiding. He says about the hopeless realism that he wants to defend, I quote, that it counsels society to behave differently. Next page he says, political philosophy remains aspirational. It sets sound standards which are not met but could be met, and it tells us to meet them. So there, he's making the point that aspirational political philosophy may not tell each individual person what they should do given how other people are likely to behave, but he does seem to think that it nonetheless counsels society as a collective body to change rules and institutions in the way the theory identifies. However, shortly after that, I think we have a somewhat different picture that came out, I think, rather clearly in his comments when he was talking about a comparison between political philosophy and higher maths, where the role of political philosophy is rather seen as establishing a certain kind of truth, whether or not that truth has any practical consequences. So he might, for example, say that it aims to establish the truth about justice, and that would make the theory evaluative. I mean, one could then use the theory to say whether a society, any given society, was just or not, but not necessarily practical in the sense of giving us reasons to act in one way or another. I mean, just in case it's not clear how theory can be evaluative but not action guiding, I might say it's a bad thing that it rains so much in Manchester because it makes people there rather gloomy. That's an evaluative judgment, but it's not, at least for the moment, an action guiding one. Now, I think it's important not to decide which of these two views of political philosophy one takes. I'm going to defend the practical view, and later on I'll suggest it creates some problems for David's hopeless realism. But let's just notice that there can be different forms of political writing that are normative in the broadest sense. One of these would be a form of political satire, where the aim is to expose the moral failings of existing society by describing an ideal world in which creatures behave very differently. More's Utopia is sometimes read in that way. Perhaps the clearest example is the infamous fourth book of Gulliver's Travels, the voyage Gulliver takes to the land of the perfectly rational and perfectly benevolent Houyhnhnms, the horses. Now, the purpose of these kinds of exercise may vary. It can just be a kind of moral exposure of hypocrisy in present society, or it may take the form of an attempt to persuade people to seek their own spiritual salvation by turning away from political life. The message may be, if you want to find true justice, you can only find it in the city of God. Now, writing in that vein could be described as political philosophy, but I want to keep the term for something narrower, namely writing that urges its addressees to act together to make the world conform more closely to the principles it lays down. And it seems to me that in some parts of the paper, though not towards the end of his talk, David seemed to share that view. Now, political philosophy must be action-guiding, but it needn't be immediately action-guiding, and that's for the reason that it may only be possible to enact certain principles under favourable circumstances, and it may be circumstances are not now favourable, in which case we have to wait until they change. So it may be, for example, that liberal democratic institutions can only be made to work in societies that have reached a certain level of economic development. If we belong to a society that's below that threshold, then we shouldn't aim directly to install liberal democratic institutions, but, for example, try instead to hasten economic growth. Or it may be that there are changes that require a certain collective agent to carry them through, and that agency doesn't at present exist. So a political philosophy needn't be feasible in the sense that it can guide action and one can act successfully on its principles here and now. But in order to be action guiding, I think it must be feasible in a different sense, namely that it would be possible for people to live according to its principles under favourable circumstances. But now, what is feasible mean in this context? And David, as we've seen, draws an important distinction between what it's possible for people to do and what they're likely in fact to do, and points out that it's not a criticism of a political theory, that people are not likely to act as the theory requires. Though later he introduces a third consideration, one of demandingness. He says a theory can be false not only by requiring the impossible, but also by virtue of being unreasonably harsh, as he puts it, meaning it demands more of people than can reasonably be demanded. And an example that he used kind of illustrates that. Well, suppose political theory includes the requirement that children should be taken from their parents soon after birth and raised in some kind of collective dormitory, with thereafter parents only having rather limited contact with their own offspring. Well, one can easily think of reasons that would support that practice, for example, some concern for equality of opportunity. But I think that requirement is too demanding. The bond between parent and child is too strong for that separation to be acceptable to those who have to undergo it. And I think, you know, experience, for example, in Israeli kibbutzim, which first tried to have precisely that kind of collective system of child rearing, showed that this was an unreasonably demanding requirement. Well, if then the realist part of hopeless realism means that political philosophy shouldn't be unreasonably demanding in what it requires of people, and if the hopeless part is meant only to signal that it may not be possible to act on the theory here and now, then it looks like we might well be in agreement, particularly in the light of what he says about the importance of developing concessive theory alongside aspirational theory. In other words, theories that tell us what to do, given the facts as they are, given what people are in practice likely to do, as well as an aspirational theory that doesn't have to adjust to those facts. Nonetheless, I still have two major concerns about aspirational theory as understood by David, and I want to explore these in the remaining part of this short comment. And they really, I think, connect principally to the last section about danger and the dangers of hopeless theory. And the first concern is one that he himself has referred to, but I think maybe needs to take more seriously. And using the concessive aspirational distinction, I think one could put it in the following way. That it's tempting to see concessive theory as a kind of halfway house to aspirational theory. In other words, by following concessive theory, we can get some way along the road to the goal that's identified in aspirational theory. We can't make our society fully just, let's say, by the standards of justice laid down in the aspirational theory, but we can get halfway there, and concessive theory tells us how to do it. An aspirational theory informs concessive theory because it tells us what perfect justice would be, and therefore what halfway justice looks like. That's the nested metaphor that David uses. But now suppose there is no such halfway house. It's the full works or nothing. Mm-hmm. If we aim for what looks like the halfway house, then we end up making things much worse than they are now. That might be, well, David suggested it himself, that there can be, for example, social rules that work very well if people comply fully with them, but work very badly if there's only partial compliance. Or there may, for example, be complementarity, something he also mentioned. Feature A has desirable consequences when combined with features B and C, but not otherwise. Democratically elected governments produce good results when the rule of law is well established, but in its absence, they may be actually worse than certain kinds of elite rule. So then an aspirational theory that's hopeless may prove to be detrimental because it encourages us to form the wrong kind of concessive theory. It encourages us to imagine and try to move towards a halfway house that doesn't in fact exist. On the other hand, there may be a halfway house of sorts, but in order to pass through it, things would have to get considerably worse than they are at present. And that raises questions about costs and benefits over time and between generations that aspirational theory as such can't accommodate. It just tells us what the best society would look like if and when we get there. But it may be that there are costs we should not impose on the present generation, even if the results of imposing those costs would be that some future generation would enjoy the benefits laid out in our aspirational theory. And I think history of the last century makes it only too clear that's not just a hypothetical concern. Even if, let's say, Mao's great leap forward really had been a leap forward to something much better, it would not have been justifiable to kill 20 million or more people in order to get there. I think George Orwell memorably summed this up in his idea of catastrophic gradualism. I quote Orwell, "The formula usually employed is, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. And if one replies, yes, but where is the omelette? The answer is likely to be, oh well, you can't expect everything to happen all in a moment." Now, I'm not accusing David of catastrophic gradualism, but I think it's a major danger or defect in aspirational theory that it gives us no safeguards against it. There's nothing in it that prevents catastrophic gradualism from following. So my first concern then about aspirational theory is that, and David has in this, in the paper, he didn't talk about it today, a nice metaphor of a party of people arriving at a nice place to make some sort of camp or resting place, and they see in the distance an even more beautiful spot, but between them and this beautiful place, there's a rather deep sort of chasm they don't know yet whether they have to cross. And and David argues that this shouldn't prevent them from thinking about and evaluating the beautiful landscape. My worry is that the chasm may either be impossible to cross or it may be so deep that it's wrong to try to move through it. But my second worry comes into play, even if it turns out that the path to the beautiful landscape rises slowly but steadily upwards. And if it has to do with the length of the path and with what might motivate people to step along it. Because every step is going to make things a bit better, X hypothesi, but the value of each step can presumably be measured by the fraction of the goal that's being achieved. So the more distant the goal, the less valuable each step will be, and the less reason there will be to take that step. So I think in that way, aspirational theory can have a chilling effect, to use the phrase that David uses about anti-utopianism. By setting normative standards very high, it can make practical political action seem to have relatively little significance. So to give a concrete example, suppose a theory defines justice as requiring perfect income equality. I suppose also that one looks around at the distribution of incomes in different societies and chooses as one's practical target getting the Gini coefficient down in one's own society to the lowest level one can observe anywhere else, let's say the Swedish levels. That's the kind of practical goal. Still, by the standards of the aspirational theory, getting to Swedish levels of inequality would still leave us with a great deal of inequality in existence. We're nowhere near what the theory demands. So the question is, why struggle to achieve what's only a small fraction of what justice really requires? And again, we have a kind of political illustration of that from the last century. I give you the failure, in many cases, of communist and far-left parties to support and ally themselves with social democrats on the grounds that what the social democrats were proposing was just a marginally more benign form of capitalism, and indeed if your political philosophy is embodied in the Marxian idea of communism, social democracy is really only a small step forward. Now I think, I think David's slightly response to this, in fact it was sort of foreshadowed in his comments, is that these are indeed political dangers in aspirational theory, but they do nothing to invalidate the theory itself. But if we do keep to the idea that political theory must be action-guiding, then it must be a defect in the theory, not just a danger, that it actually guides people in the wrong direction. Even philosophers who don't concern themselves with the kind of vulgar political questions I've been raising recognize that practical theories can be self-defeating, meaning that if people try to act on the principles that the theory lays down, they end up producing outcomes that are the very opposite of what the theory intends. Now, of course, there are different ways in which theories can be self-defeating, and it may be that David and I would turn out to disagree about what would count as a theory being self-defeating, in particular, how far facts about human psychology should be used to determine whether or not a theory is self-defeating. That may come up in discussion. Well, anyway, there's much more to say about this, I think, very stimulating paper, including the question of what a practical philosophy must be like to count as a political philosophy. But I'm going to stop now, so no discussion.
Thank you very much indeed.